I'm Joe Lindstroth. I'm the executive producer of Stateside. I also produced The Next Idea with Jeff DeGraff, who is the Dean of Innovation, as a nickname. He's a Ross College of Business professor. His clients include, can I divulge a few, Jeff?
A lot of people.
A lot of people, including San Antonio Spurs, General Electric, Apple. You've heard of him. His most recent book is called The Innovation Code. Moving on down the line, on the far end here with the Michigan sweatshirt here is Nathan Lutz. He's a senior counsel at Meijer, based in the Grand Rapids area. After unfortunately graduating from Ohio State, which you wouldn't know here, he got his law degree from University of Chicago. And being not from Michigan, he kind of has an outsider's point of view and a passion for bringing new ideas and new ways of connecting with people to one of West Michigan's most iconic companies, and just in general. And I do want to stress the panel up here, they're here as Michigan citizens tonight, not representing corporations, companies, et cetera. They're just here to participate in this dialogue that we think is worth it. And just next to Nate is Lauren Bigelow. She's CEO of Growth Capital Network, an Ann Arbor-based firm that manages projects in healthcare, philanthropy, and innovation. She helped start Accelerate Michigan, which is the premier huge startup competition that happens every year. She's on numerous advisory boards, including the Urban Institute and the Alliance for the Great Lakes. And then next to Lauren is Eric Thomas. He's a brand strategist and senior partner with Saga, a Detroit-based agency that uses storytelling to elevate their clients' brands. He's a leading voice among entrepreneurs in Detroit, and in 2016, he poo-poos it, but it's a pretty big deal. He was named to the list of Crain's Detroit's 20 in their 20s. So please give a welcome to our panel here tonight who came out. Appreciate it. All right, so what do we want to talk about? So I don't know about you, I'm not from here, but in doing this project and working on Stateside and basically living in Michigan, sometimes this state feels like five states. There's a lot of regional differences here, as one might know, in Michigan. And we kind of got to talking a number of themes on Stateside about, well, how does that help hinder our economy as a whole when we have kind of siloed things happening across the state. So we thought we'd kind of bring some folks from each of the main economic hubs, and I understand there's other places doing wonderful things in Michigan, but we chose Grand Rapids, Ann Arbor, and Detroit, and then brought Jeff in to have a dialogue here about how we can collaborate, what sort of these silos, how they manifest themselves in the economy, and what we can do about it to move the whole state forward. So first, I'm going to put you guys on the spot a little bit. I'd like each of you, and Eric, I'll start with you. What do the haters say about Detroit?
You're going to ask me what the haters say about Detroit.
What's the reputation of people of Detroit outside of Detroit?
It's interesting because as a Detroiter, I actually wrote an article called Why I Hate Detroit, so you've come to the right guy.
I know I did.
So there is this idea that Detroit is like an untamed jungle where there are just thugs and criminals snatching poor white children out of cars as they drive through. And I don't really know where that came from. If Detroit was that bad, how would anyone live there? There are 700,000 people in Detroit. It's 140 square miles. And I think there's a lot of confusion about, I think, what is Detroit's primary export? What is Detroit's current status on its comeback? Which is, like, we think Detroit is back for some reason. Like, downtown is a whole city. And then we have a strange disconnect from the history of Detroit. Right, so it was just the 50-year anniversary of the 67 rebellion, rising, uprising, whatever you want to call it. And so I'm happy I get to have this conversation in this room because there doesn't seem to be a whole bunch of Detroiters in here. And so I had the privilege of working on the narrative and the story. And
They collected hundreds of oral histories of people who lived in Detroit during the uprising and during the riots. Some people call it a riot. Some people call it an uprising. And I think this is the linchpin on how you talk about what the haters think about Detroit. People think Detroit, what happened in Detroit in 67 was a riot because they were able to completely ignore the 30 years and 40, 50 years of racism and redlining that put people into a situation where their backs were against the wall. So to a lot of people, Detroit burst into flames one day because black people just went crazy and we just burned everything down for no reason. And then it created this cycle of a perpetuating idea that Detroit is an unruly mob at all times. And so I think that is the biggest misconception about Detroit. Well, there's like people in Detroit, and there have been for a long time.
Great. Thanks, Eric. Lauren, what do the haters say about Ann Arbor?
Wow.
They uppity.
Yep. We're uppity.
I'm sorry. Is that Lauren?
No. I know my voice got deep, but it's okay. He was channeling me. We are. We're uppity. We're arrogant. We're overeducated. We can be very dismissive, elitist. I'm trying to think of some other gems I have. I mean, and one of the challenges is that the way that I experience Ann Arbor, you know, I grew up in New York. I moved to Michigan when I was in high school. All of those things that you say about Ann Arbor, you know, individually are true. You know, you'll have somebody, you know, I ran the IT zone, the predecessor to Spark, from 2000 to early 2004. And we were trying to come together with Tech Town out of Detroit and Automation Alley out of Oakland County and a little bit with Macomb and OU. And we put proposals together, and I would bring them to my board here, and they would just destroy them because they didn't want to deal with it. They didn't have to deal with anybody else. And so, you know, we've got the intellectual capital and the venture capital, and we can. Ann Arbor can be its own self-enclosed place and thrive. But the reality is we have a lot of neighbors in Washtenaw County that need our services and our resources here, and we have a lot of people in southeastern Michigan, again, that need our resources and our talents. And then we're also a great space for the state. So I think that sometimes Ann Arbor, in its own myopic nature, can be really miserly and very elitist.
And Nate, finally, Grand Rapids. What do the haters say about the Grand Rapids area?
The haters say about Grand Rapids, we're pretty white. Conservative. Yeah, bad place for minorities. Conservative. Overly religious, and not like in a good way. That I suppose you could probably say that we're run by a few wealthy families. And we're gun toting. You know, we're just, you know, kind of these crazy wilderness people. I don't know. Is that enough, Joe? You want me
to? That'll work. All right, I'll stop you now. I'll let you keep going until you stop it.
I think we've moved past it, but you know, Ann Arbor was always the like hippie, crunchy, you know, lesbians and Subarus,
right.
Kind of, you know, yeah, unkempt people.
I mean, that was even when I was undergrad here in the 90s. That's long. It seems quite different now. All right, so we kind of have some of the more colloquial perspectives, I guess, of these regions. I want to bring Jeff DeGraff in here now. Jeff, over the course of the next idea, you've had a really good way of describing in economic terms the differences between these three areas. Give us that.
Yeah, there's a lot of research on how economies grow, and it has a lot to do with how things sync up and where you actually get density. And they're all the kind of institutes. They're the progressive institutes like Brookings and the more conservative ones like RAND. And basically what they say is that economies basically have what's called externalities. They have to have on-ramps and off-ramps. It's a fancy way of saying that. And my big thing is, I've from the very beginning of the program, starting the program with Tamar and the conversations with the MEDC and the governor, had a lot to do with, I'm actually from Western Michigan. I'm one of the few professors here. Who is? There's, I think, 190 professors in the Ross School of Business. Less than a dozen of us are from the state. I think I'm the only one from the western side of the state. So I speak both languages. You know, I speak both west and east, if you will. I've been here in Ann Arbor forever. So what always occurred to me from the very beginning, when we started trying to build an innovation economy, and some of us were here from the very onset of this, what struck us about Ann Arbor is something that still strikes all of you. It's the most educated zip code in the United States. I don't know if you know this, 48103. I think it's 67% of the households, somebody holds a terminal degree. It's now, according to Forbes, has the most venture capital per person. Whether that's true or not is debatable, but certainly it's certainly the startup capital of the upper Midwest. The challenge is, when you start looking at like the president's report at the U of M, we're not able to keep our people here. So the problem is, we've all had, I think a lot of us here have had the experience of having students who've gone off to do very, very well, but they don't do very well in the state. They start here and then they go. So let's call these, for even though it's technically not correct, let's call these small capital. This is small capital. Small businesses that start to grow up and maybe become a unicorn, and Lauren can do something with that. But the other part is then you look at Grand Rapids, and Grand Rapids is a family town. So when you look at Grand Rapids and you look at Money Magazine and you look at healthcare, you look at what Spectrum Health has done on the west side of the state, it's an employment magnet. And if you look at the entire state in terms of the number of jobs created, it's kind of an ideal picture of that. Yes, there are some issues, particularly if you're on this side of the state, what you believe about it, but what you cannot refute is the growth engine. It's done incredibly well. The challenge, of course, is that these are mid-cap companies. They don't really kind of get to that huge number. The irony is Detroit, for all of the challenges in Detroit, still has well over almost 20 of the Fortune 500. I don't know if people know this. These are the large cap companies that basically employ tens of thousands of people, of course, with some of the automation that becomes the challenge. I love what Eric said. People forget that Detroit is the size, listen to this, of San Francisco, Boston, and the island of Manhattan put together. It's 142,000 acres. The part of Detroit that's being gentrified, the Woodward Corridor, is 14 acres.
7.2 square miles.
There you go. So the notion is, what you've got in Detroit is you've got the ability to create large businesses, but you have an incredibly large footprint. So here's basically what the economic reports say. If you could find a way to take the small companies in Ann Arbor, find an off-ramp for them, meaning money, jobs, and places people want to live. This is a big thing. The president's report at U of M is very clear. We're having huge talent flight. We can't keep the kids here. It's an enormous problem. I think in the entire United States, I was reading recently that people were saying the talent flight has been curbed, and I think in the United States we're number 38, which is very disappointing, right? We're in the bottom quartile. We're stinking it up. So the issue is, could you move them to someplace else in the state? And Grand Rapids isn't the only landing place, but could we land them somewhere? Affordable housing. In Ann Arbor, as you well know, that's becoming an insanely difficult issue. There's no cheap places to live around here anymore. And could those mid-cap companies sink back to what's going on in Detroit? Could they become large capitalized companies? That becomes the real challenge. And there's two schools of thought. The one school of thought says sinking it up is a very good idea, but remember, that's what got us into trouble the first time. The other school of thought says every tub on its own bottom, that in fact this might be better that we're separate. I'm going to let the panelists and your audience members talk about what they think the right approach is, but that's kind of a framing device, I think, of where we're at.
That's great. Thanks, Jeff. And I want to get to that a little bit later about these differences and just how unique they may be are to Michigan and whether that's necessarily a bad thing. But first, maybe Lauren, sir, how do you see, I mean, you've been involved in the entrepreneurship space and venture capital and now in Michigan for a long time. How do you see these differences, these regional differences, kind of play out on the ground as you go to work every day, if you do?
I definitely see it in terms of Grand Rapids. There's a fantastic angel group out called the Grand Angels, and they are pretty parochial in terms of where they put their capital. Occasionally, they'll kind of move across the midline of the state, but it's mostly concentrated on the west side of the state, kind of from Holland down to St. Joe. The money, the sponsorships, even when we were doing Accelerate Michigan, which was very much a statewide competition. As a matter of fact, at our third competition, Grand Rapids swept every single category we had. But we never got any love from from Meijer or Spectrum or anybody over there, because they're like, you're a Detroit thing, and you know, we just really don't see past that. And so we've seen that on the early stage entrepreneurial piece, though, there's a lot of flow back and forth. There's a lot of people working with advisors in Spectrum, advisors in Stryker out in Lansing. The ecosystem within southeastern Michigan, literally at one point, you could stand on the corner of Washington and Maine in Ann Arbor, spin, and be within 90% of all the VC in the entire state. Yep. It was in just like five buildings in downtown Ann Arbor. It's expanded. Dan Gilbert in Detroit has done a lot around that. Invest Detroit, which was their early stage seed money, which was seeded a lot by the Community Foundation of Southeastern Michigan, and their new economy initiative. Those types of seed capital, the microloans, most of those folks look at Detroit and Ann Arbor as the region. And as a matter of fact, one of the key pieces that the philanthropic funders have done is, remember I told you about that little fission between Automation Alley and Tech Town, and you know how they serve, they figured that out? $3 million to just get people to sit at the table. Seven-figure check for those four organizations to play nice in the sandbox. And the nice thing is that now, 5 years later, most of the leaders of those organizations have since retired or moved on to other positions, and so their lieutenants, who never had a problem with each other, who were the people who worked with each other, are now the leaders of those organizations, and we're getting a more close-knit fabric between the entrepreneurial community in southeastern Michigan, these seven counties writ large. And all of our folks are kind of like, hey, Tech Town does these things really well. Ann Arbor Spark does these things really well. Automation Alley, we leave manufacturing, advanced materials to them. So we've really understood each other in a way that's, you know, over the 18 years I've been in the ecosystem, has really developed into something strong, but we still have an east-west challenge.
Eric, do you feel part of a Detroit Ann Arbor region?
Heck no. I was just talking about this. I think this might have been the fifth time I've ever been to Ann Arbor. But, which is interesting, my business partner is a U of M grad, right? So he's always in Ann Arbor and always talking about it. Something about U of M grads. They really like Ann Arbor. I don't know what y'all got in the water around here.
Beer.
Is it beer? Is it? It's trees. You guys got trees. Detroit. Like, Detroit as a place has always been kind of an island unto itself. Well, not always, but for about 50 years. I just turned 30, so as long as I've been alive, Detroit has been its own thing. And it's interesting. There are kids that I know from the neighborhood I've grown up with who've never left Detroit. Like, not like the metro Detroit area. I'm talking about Detroit, like not been to Dearborn, not been to Canada, not been, you know, to Royal Oak in Birmingham. I hadn't gone to Birmingham in Oakland County until I was 17 years old. It really creates this insulated space. The situation is simply this. If you really want to engage Detroit, you kind of have to go and prove that you're not dangerous. And I know that sounds messed up, but I'll give you an example of why this is, because this is cultural. This is very much cultural, and so I'm going to say about 4.5 offensive-ass things, so bear with me. So my mother, God rest her soul, she just passed in December. My mom told me one day when I was 11, she looked me dead in the face. She said, Eric, never trust white people. She said, never trust them. You cannot trust them. No matter what happens, they will turn on you. Now, that sounds hyperbolic. That sounds insane to some folks. But I'm going to ask you one question, and one question alone, white folks in the room. When in history have white people ever showed up on the shore and it went well for the people that were on the island already? Does anybody have a time in history? It didn't even go well for white folks. Like, when Greeks showed up to the barbarians, white people show up to white people. It goes badly for the people that were there before. And so we exist in this idea where when people start to show up, we're about to lose things. And so you really kind of have to be ready for the afraid 60, 70-year-old woman who's held onto her property against all odds. When you say, hey, I'm Sarah and I'm here to help. What are you here to help with? How do you know what my challenges are?
How do you know what we need in our community? Do you think poverty needs an app? Probably not. So when you're talking about design thinking, are you talking about it in a purely academic and collegiate sense? Or are you talking about it in a way to solve problems and include people? The other part of that is the way we think about how talent manifests. What I mean by that is you say, oh, we have a talent drain or a lack of talent in a city like Detroit. That's not necessarily true. What we have is a lack of talent that represents itself in a way that you have previously experienced. We look for talent in a way that we are comfortable with. And so when somebody's speaking Ebonics or a language you don't necessarily understand, when somebody's speaking broken English because they're from Bangladesh, that doesn't mean they're not an engineer. That means they just don't speak English well. And so that's very different. So I think that's why we have a fundamental disconnect, because we speak a different language in Detroit.
What do you think about so it sounds like race and culture with Detroit.
We're 85% black. It's a bunch of us.
Indeed. Indeed. So jumping right into it then. How do you move that forward?
Before Eric goes, I just want to say I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and so Joe said let's get into it. We all know what's going, things that are going on in the news. And for me, I'm 44. I'm a white man, middle aged, and I'm a little bit threatened about my career as far as what potential do I have? Because I have, baby boomers sort of on one side, that are holding on for whatever reason. And then there's people like Eric that are coming up and just Jeff's students that are absolutely brilliant. And so there's fear even for me. And so when Eric talks about the fear of people in Detroit, black people in Detroit towards white people, there's fear over on the west side of the state. Like, well, what are we going to have to give up if we give someone else something? Are we going to lose something? It's this concept of this zero sum game. Like, I only win if you lose, and I don't know what the solution is to that. But I just wanted to throw that in because I don't think it's just fear for one group.
No, I think that. Well, I think that's kind of what we're getting at is these silos and evolve with. Beyond just economics, moving this forward, is there anything working right now, or anything that you can point to, maybe either of you that you see is something that's getting you out of silos? Even if it's just, man, last week I met someone from Ann Arbor, and that seemed to kind of work. Is there something that you see? Any of you over here on the panel. Go ahead, Eric. You look ready to talk.
You have to be really, really intentional about diversity. Because our innate sense is to kind of gravitate to people that make us comfortable, people that are like us. And so I think you make a very valid point. And I've had this conversation in my silo of super-duper black friends about how little credit we give to white males when we say, when you really look at what we're asking when we talk about diversity. And I think, women and minorities have to be very cognizant. If you have a board, and that board is 10 white males on that board, and you say, we need to diversify this board, we're not saying add more board seats. We're saying fire 5 board members, right? And then add women and minorities to those seats. And that's why I ask them all the time. I'm like, so which one of you is getting out of your seat when people need to add more young people or more Hispanic people to those seats? And so we really need to have a real conversation about what does it mean to diversify. We do understand that there are these historic barriers. But sacrifice is a real thing. We're asking for sacrifice without understanding what we're asking for sometimes.
And I might move. Go ahead, Laura.
I think it's incumbent upon people who are here in Ann Arbor. I've heard a lot of things back and forth. We brought Steve Case here in October for a discussion around, engaging Southeastern Michigan. And there was a whole bunch of people from Ann Arbor in the room who were like, oh, yeah, we really need to work with Detroit. But they never go there. It drives me crazy. We have an office in Detroit. One of the things when I was working in Southwest with a number of entrepreneurs, I work for the New Economy Initiative. We do evaluation for them. We were in Southwest. And I was sitting there talking to a mom who couldn't feed her kids, How are you going to start a business when you can't feed your children? And so one of the things that started really interesting me was doing, you know, looking at nutrition and food insecurity in Detroit. So we did a ton of pro bono work for Gleaners Community Food Bank and just finished probably 7 different evaluations for them over the last year and talked to the people on the ground in the pantries, their clients, and gave the information that those pantries have never had back to those clients. So we brought the skills of mathematicians and social workers to Detroit to try to help them understand what challenges they were actually they were encountering on the ground. And so for me, it's incumbent upon the folks in Ann Arbor and our intellectual capital here and in Grand Rapids to address and help support the people who are supporting the citizens in Detroit. So that's where I sort of, you know, feel like people need to shut up and step up.
I want to move off, take this diversity and move it forward. Eric, you had mentioned something as diversity is looked at as a sacrifice. And I think, Jeff, your work on diversity actually says it's essential. I mean, it's economically essential. We're not even talking about kumbaya here. We're not talking about what's the moral thing to do. We're talking about pure survival, economic survival.
Yeah, there's... depending on whose research you talk to, there's about 30 to 50 places on the planet that produce most of the intellectual property. Most of the GDP is driven out of these. And ironically, Ann Arbor's kind of made that list. It's been moving up the list thanks to our panelists here. The work that I've done with the Chinese lady over here, who happens to be my wife, on predicting stock prices. So diversity happens at home in my house. Actually looks at these places, and the one thing they have in common is they're very diverse. And my theory and her theory about this is because innovation is driven by constructive conflict. Not destructive, but constructive conflict. And I won't bore you with all the research areas. But I want to pick up on a couple things that people have said here that I don't know if I want to challenge it, but I want to reposition some things. First of all, if you get out an almanac and you look at when Detroit started losing population, it started in 1950. It did not start in 1967. And it was the drain of manufacturing jobs after the war. So the notion is, when everybody talks about we're going back to manufacturing, first of all those jobs being automated, that's a model that worked before, but we know starting in 1950 it stopped working. The second thing is that when we start looking at Detroit, we often separate it from the rest of the state. The state of Michigan, according to the Department of Education, last year finished 47th out of 50 states in the United States for education levels and percentage of population that holds a bachelor degree, 14%, as opposed to the Midwest average, 21%. So the notion is we've got some problems that are not Detroit problems. We got a lot of problems that are our problems, right? And they were created way before we had Detroit. But here becomes the problem. And it's, I think Lauren really hit on it, and I like what... Nate had said about this and what Eric had said about this. The problem is when we start looking at how things grow, and there's a bunch of theories about this, but I'm going to school you in one basic theory that the Brookings Institute seems to think is correct with their modern research. And that's there was a famous Harvard economist named Joseph Schumpeter. Anybody heard of Schumpeter and Schumpeter cycles? Okay. Well, Schumpeter wrote this famous book in 1945, right before he dies. It's called Democracy, Capitalism, and Socialism. And Schumpeter has a warning. He says what happens when you're going to see a shift is that the economics are concentrated in one area until they're upset by another. So think about one of our students, Larry Page. Think about what happened with the digital economy. Those who are old enough to remember, some of these were my students in the 90s. Remember how that boat tipped over. That's a Schumpeter cycle. And Schumpeter said they were longer than they really are now. So there's a lot of debate around that. But the thing that Schumpeter warned about was he said the minute that you decide through democracy to redistribute capital, what happens is you dilute the cycle. You prolong the cycle. You don't see the thing flip over to where there's a new renaissance where people are now enjoying a new sense of prosperity, if this makes sense to you. So here becomes the interesting question. Do you allow these economic hubs to ripen, to create sort of these epicenters where there's capital for taxes, capital for schools, capital for things, or do you immediately dissipate it? Because if you don't, you won't get reelected. And that becomes the fundamental conundrum. right? Now, I'm a business school professor, and my name is DeGraff, right? So I'm on the side of economics. I believe that economics sort things out over time, and we all have to admit that we're in a protracted period of high-density capitalism, which means the Templeton Foundation studied where we got the 1% number. We're going through this. But we've actually seen this before. This is not the first time we've seen this. We've seen this three or four times before, right? We know a little bit about it. The issue is, do we want to try and spread all that out right now, right? Because that's how people get reelected, and whether we create enough critical mass in these economies to create the new economy becomes a question. Or do we allow the cycle to continue, right? That becomes the interesting debate question in the room here, doesn't it? How do you play this thing?
I think jumping off of that, Jeff, I guess it brings to mind for me, I mean, the role of government.
Or is there a role?
I guess that's exactly right. Is there a role here for government to play in... I mean, we have the MEDC here. You know, they've been involved to various degrees and under, you know, various effectiveness over the years in trying to bolster economic development throughout the state. Lauren, you have experience with them. What do you think the role of government could be or should be in this area?
From 2010, when Mike Finney, who used to run Ann Arbor Spark, through 2015, they put about $25 million a year into the innovation ecosystem and saw a 22x return on that money. They did microloans, they did seed funds, they helped raise a couple of new venture funds. And what that did was it took really early stage commercializable technology, and it helped them slowly grow with a little bit of capital and a lot more community support until they were, you know, for lack of a better phrase, kind of potty trained and walking. They helped support Accelerate Michigan, which during my tenure gave away more than $7 million all across the state to companies in a very diverse group of technologies. They were instrumental in a thing called the Translational Research and Commercialization piece, which was teaching researchers at our public universities. We've got a transportation hub here at Michigan, medical, ag up over at Michigan State, and advanced materials at Michigan Tech, really trying to focus in on getting those technology companies out. So they spent their money wisely. They did really good evaluation analytics, and it's... I think it was the budget cycle I testified, I think it was 3 years ago, in front of the House committee. And I didn't actually know that there was a large vein that could bulge out of my head during a meeting. But it was on CCTV, and people told me about it. But they took a $25 million budget and shredded it down to 15, despite the fact that we could prove a 22x return. I mean, who doesn't want that on their money? And we could see, like, in the 18 years that since I started working for the IT Zone, the amount of technology companies that have burgeoned in our state and have created jobs and have kept people here, you know, that's the interesting, sexy things. The kids want to, like, go to a startup. You know, those are the companies that money has helped to create. And... yeah, our legislators, particularly with term limits, can be very myopic because they're just looking to get reelected. And long-term vision is something that we're sorely lacking. But that capital created what we've got right now.
Flip it to the other side, the opposite of government intervention. And let's shift to networking and building networks. And forget what government can do, but you... as entrepreneurs, as business folks, as people looking to move the needle forward in your own career and also more broadly in where you live, in your communities, when you build networks, where are your holes in your networks? Nate, do you have holes in your networks from other regions? I mean, do you find, as you're out there, are you talking to people in Ann Arbor and Detroit like you feel like you should?
My network is undeliberate, and I've kind of taken what comes to me and what's just more natural. And so I was having this thought on the way here. I don't know what the ecosystem for entrepreneurship is in Michigan. I know the MEDC. I don't know if there's like a different version of it, if there's this, if there's that. I'm aware of some of the things going on in Detroit, some of the things going on in Ann Arbor. I find my network, though, more with people that I like versus, who's going to be that big name or who's that big flashy person. And, being here tonight with the panel, I could see why you and Jeff have assembled us, because we're all very different. There's, I think, a kind of a pragmatic way we approach things. So my whole is, I don't know a whole lot about Detroit. I don't know a whole lot about Ann Arbor, and I've deliberately been coming over here more frequently to help educate myself. I would say, Lauren's event, Accelerate Michigan, I went there in November, and I felt like the most popular person in the world. Everyone was like, oh, you're from Meijer. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And this isn't being taped, is it? I'm kidding. I was like, well, how come, where's the other 10 people from Meijer? How come we're not getting over here? There's some really, really great things going on. I was in a fantastic, the Masonic Temple was a great setting, and I was the only person, and I left somewhat frustrated. So it's things like this and people that maybe I'll meet tonight or have been up here and talked with, and that will be the next step. So it's there's lots of holes, I think.
Sure, sure. Eric, how about you? I know from your Facebook posts, you're out there networking. You're working.
Yeah. So I'll frame this kind of with the previous question, what I think the government is for and what it's not for.
Okay.
I say this as an entrepreneur who grew up super low income, right? My grandmother made like $600 a month, so that's what she raised us on. And it was like everybody in my family, my mom, dad, and yada, yada. So it didn't really work out too well with the $600 a month. I think the government's job is to set a floor for opportunity, right? Like, it's not – government is notoriously awful at business. Like, return, like you said, what kind of person wouldn't want to return on their money? The government. They're just, like, eating it and throwing it away. But I've had to be very intentional about my network because I didn't grow up with the network. When I meet people who are successful and their friends are successful, I found out they went to, like, junior high school together. You're like, everybody who went to Cranbrook, so everyone's doing well. Well, I went to Parkman Elementary on Joy Road, where we had gangs and yada yada. And so those aren't the people you meet at the networking event. And when you need access to capital and when you need projects, I think our average project price at this point is like $50,000 or something. Like, that's not coming from low income communities. And so I found that I have to be intentional. I've actually set a goal to travel this year. So if anybody wants me to come to wherever they are, to whatever their business is, and just sit in so I can just learn and see how you do business and learn how you communicate, because that's really important. When you meet new people, you find that they're also communicating differently. You have these clashes. I love what you said about those collisions, because that's where innovation happens. When you find out that some people put the toilet paper one way and other people put the toilet paper the other way, you would never know that without those collisions. And so you have to be intentional, especially if you grew up without. I think women run into similar things where you get there and you're like the only woman and you're like, what in the heck is going on in here?
The first clean tech, women in clean tech, was literally in the ladies' room. There were 9 of us, and when we started the whole network and clean energy, it was just easy.
Did you find that you had to like go out and network with like these guys and bring those relationships back to the group? Because we do that too.
Yeah. But the other thing too is we supported each other as a core in a way that was like mother bear like, in that everybody had their backs to each other and we looked out in the world and we just really had each other's backs. And as the group expanded and expanded, we brought other women in that we trusted and brought in our advocates. And I have to tell you, like in clean tech, it was far more intentional. One of the things I'm lucky, I am a finance lecturer at Ross, and my students are constantly saying, oh, you're 1 degree of separation away from that person. can you connect me with them? So I am constantly on the phone going, hi, I'm Lauren, and this is my pedigree, and I've got some really great students at Ross, and they'd like to work with you. So interestingly enough, in addition to sort of my own networking, my students push me into new arenas as well, both in energy and finance.
Jeff, maybe you can chime in. In hearing this, we talked about government and individuals and kind of self-actualizing behavior. Sorry to use one of your terms, Jeff. Of kind of going out there and being it. Eric, you mentioned it is my goal this year to travel, to go and see how other people do business. You know, Nate, you said it's about my making efforts to connect with people. Are there models that we can look at in other states or other things that bring together that are a little bit more intentional than just a bunch of individuals trying to be intentional in their own lives?
No.
Does that make sense?
No, there aren't. And I want to talk about what's happening, why this is important. I like what Eric had said. My father was a union committee man for the AIW. I grew up in a very kind of left-wing house. And I know what it's like to be poor, right? I know what that's like. That's how I came up. I think what's interesting to me is that we're sitting on what I think is the largest shift in about 200 years, and I think people have got this wrong. Whenever something gets large, it has to optimize. So you're trying to show quarterly earnings to investors. And that means you're eliminating deviance. You're eliminating things that are not standard. Everybody follow this? That's why we have hierarchies, and hierarchies exist in large organizations when they become really large, go from being these kind of interesting startups, this mashup, if you will, to these things that look like Amazon these days, right? Vertically integrated, they have everything. They're eating up everything. But the other side of it is we're also living in an age where we have a network economy. We've never seen a real network economy before. I talk to a lot of people my age. I'm the very last year of the baby boomers. Incidentally, millennials, you should know this. You know that you outnumber us by 4%. And if you ever showed up and voted, you'd actually have your way. But you don't. And that's,
I have a Facebook
status.
That's
your problem.
So I'm making my voice heard.
So let me. there we go. There we go. What was the state? Lost by 8,000 votes or something, whatever. But here's the thing. Network economies are horizontal, and they're intentional. And networks that are not transactional are usually not very important or very influential. This is the economics argument again. So here becomes the challenge. The challenge is, let me talk a little bit about young people and hierarchy. Let me give you three facts that are important, and don't judge. Starting in 2014, according to the New York Times, over half of all live births to women under the age of 30 are outside of marriage. Adjusted for their education level, the more educated the woman is, the less likely she is to marry. Marriage is no longer normative. That's an institution. That's fact. You're seeing this? Are you seeing this in your world? Number two, the Pew Charitable Trust did this huge study about 190,000 millennials. They asked them what they wanted to do for a living. Do they want to work for Meijer? Do they want to work for General Motors? No. They want to work for themselves, or they want to work in something that they have impact and creates meaning in their life. Right? So you're seeing this. These are my kids. These are really smart people, but they want a different life. So they're willing to live in small houses. You know, the crisis in the automobile industry isn't Tesla. Tesla sold 55,000 cars last year and lost $600 million. It's Uber. The radical revolution is they'll get in the car with a stranger. You know, I have a house on the river. It's like Airbnb. If someone came to my house and used the towel, I'd take it in the backyard, burn it, and bury it. I'd sick the dogs on you. Right? Finally, what's the fastest growing religion to people under the age of 30? And the answer is no religion. So here's the issue. We're seeing a generation that's actually the first real network generation we've ever seen. Not the 60s. Nope, it's nothing like that. They're not going to grow into boomers. We've never seen it. But all of our institutions to advance people are horizontal, especially our government, our military, our religious institutions, and particularly our educational institutions. Says Professor DeGraff, count the chevrons on my sleeve. You know, I earned every one. You got to win a lot of bar fights to get all those, right? The notion is it's different, and what you're dealing with is not an issue of opinion or culture war. You're dealing with how does the economics How do the economics flow? Do they flow vertically or do they flow horizontally? And that's what we're up against. That's what we're looking at. And you can imagine, I've never seen anything like this in my life. When the last election came up, I was in the Diag and I saw something I never saw before. When Bernie Sanders was here, it was like a religious revival. Was anybody there? And there were two groups of people there. There were young people and old people. And when's the last time you saw young people, maybe a Grateful Dead concert or something, but there weren't. I'd never seen it. And if you look at a bell curve, since the 07 recession, I was an advisor of the Federal Reserve, right, in 05 and 06. If you look at the bell curve, who were two of the groups that were dispossessed by the Great Recession? Young people and old people. Is this making sense? For the large part, in the last election, minorities opted out, which was interesting. What was left was one group that's downwardly mobile, and they made their voice heard. That's what we've got. So I think what we're looking at, not trying to make this too complicated, is I think we're looking at a shift I've never seen. Maybe this was a shift in 1890. I didn't live in the Gilded Age. I don't know. People say it's similar. Not that old. But certainly, this is the biggest shift, I think, since the Great War.
Is what we're talking about here in Michigan, is it different? Is Michigan unique? What do you think? I mean, when you travel around?
I lived in Cleveland, Ohio, and I was born and raised in Columbus, Ohio. And then there's Cincinnati, Ohio. And there's some very similar dynamics at play in Ohio. I would say your Cleveland is your Detroit, and then your Columbus is Lansing, and Cincinnati is your Grand Rapids. I don't know why that is. I'm not sure if you would look at Louisville if you'd find something similar. I think there are analogs in other states. And something I want to mention about to Jeff's point. This is about 3 years ago or so. I was really like miserable in my job. And had moved to Grand Rapids and just trying to figure things out and trying to find my purpose. I guess maybe it was a midlife crisis. And we were at a high school basketball game, and I was looking around. I was like, okay, why am I going to get up and go to work tomorrow? What am I doing? And I saw these people around the community, and it inspired me. And I have family also, and so I want to do well for them, but kind of like greater purpose. And so I've started this mission, and I guess you'd call it like disrupting yourself or something. There's probably some fancy name for it. And a lot of Jeff's self-authorizing behavior. And then we've had a relationship now for 2.5 years, and it's been phenomenal. It's taught me a whole lot. And become a little bit of a rebel within this Meyer culture, which is why I'm here tonight and why I asked Joe early on to say something about, speaking as Michigan citizens, not on behalf of organizations. Because you're a private family-owned business and from that part of the state, I want to be careful. It's really cool, though, because Jeff has made me look like I have a crystal ball. Because all of the things that I've been doing now for a couple years, everyone else at Meyer is really getting into. And you do see this flattening, and you see people that are like getting it, and then there's people that are resisting it. And it's just this microcosm of maybe what's going on in the larger economy. So it's really, really fascinating. And I have optimism that there's more people turning towards it than turning away from it. It's just right now like kind of in the middle of that change, and it's a bit ugly.
So, Joe, I think through a lot of the stuff that I'm doing with Revolution out of D.C., there's a lot of – they do a 5-day roadshow across the Midwest, and they're looking for interesting technologies and communities to bring together. And so there's a lot of communities like the ones that we have in Michigan all across the Heartland, whether it's, Kansas City or Lima, Ohio, or Champaign-Urbana. I mean – people are looking to innovation, and they're looking to new ways of doing business and new ways of existing in community. And it's funny because I'm actually a baby boomer. You and I are born the same year. But I test as a millennial, and I get so frustrated with not only the myopic nature of a lot of the baby boomers, but the fact that, like, if Eric wants me to introduce him to somebody in my network, I pen an email and I kick it off. I probably do 50 introductions a month between people because it's important for our communities to be connected. But for a lot of the people in my generation, it's a chit. There's a quid pro quo to it. And you know what? If you're from a lower economic arena, you can't do anything for me. I don't want anything from you. And there's nothing that there can't be a quid pro quo. So if we're going to have social justice and equity and real diversity in our communities, we need to help those people in a way that's paying it forward.
I would. So there's this thing. There's this, like, I will now speak on behalf of low-income people. There is this thing that is stated about them, the low income, right? And there's this idea that there's not a lot of things that come out of the low income. We must go and we must save those savages. We must bring them the fire. And I have questions about that. And this is why. Almost every culture creator ever in the history of America has been out of someone born in deficit. Musicians. All of the people that you would never hire are the people responsible for billion-dollar industries. James Brown was not secretly well-kempt, speaking the Queen's English, and then started screaming on a record. Right? Like, this isn't just, like, a new thing. They're like, we don't trust those rappers. Like, don't act like James Brown was bringing the pros. All right? James Brown was like, hey, watch me. Like, that wasn't deep. And so as you look at where culture is derived and our cultural exports as a country and as a world, it is usually created by the less desirable of us, the ones that we don't hire, the ones that we don't communicate with. And so I do think that there is something that they have to offer, that we have to offer. But it's usually a question of how did you survive? If you ask someone low income, because if you lived with a low income person for like 6 weeks, your life would change. To see the things that people make, to see how my grandmother made a life for four or five people with $600 a month, I'm talking about I ate dinner every night. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner cooked every day. I was well nourished, right? And so how? Right? And I think when you start seeing those things, like this is the design thinking thing. I'm a graphic designer by trade, moved into branding, now I'm in storytelling. How do you exist? What have you created? I know so many like low-income guys on the block who not only did they sell drugs, right? They also rapped, wrote the raps, produced the song, do the graphics, make the cover, and shot the music video for themselves. How? And there are some kids who graduated from Ross who literally can only do a spreadsheet and ask someone to do all those things. So I think we really need to start looking at what is the manifestation of talent. And then I think we would have a better way of connecting. Like we talk about networking, bridging those gaps. And we talk about millennials. I think the group under millennials, what are they, Z? That's a really unique population. I went on a bus ride with them to Omaha to see Warren Buffett. And I sat on a bus for 14 hours. And in those 14 hours, we were kids from 9 years old to 16 years old. I watched these kids communicate at four different levels. Like in-person communication, a text conversation, a Snapchat conversation, and then private Snapchats. They were creating media, developing things, filming things, editing them, doing graphics, and communicating at the same time. It's a very unique skill. And so when we're talking about connecting, I think there's a lot of things we could learn from those groups because they're not as disconnected as we say they are. They just communicate in a wavelength that's different than us.
Well, I think we got to maybe three of the 19 questions that I had prepared for the evening. But I do want to leave time for some questions, and then I'll direct a couple more. But I do want to open it up to the group here. April Van Buren is with us. She's walking around with a microphone. If you want to raise your hand, please, and we'll get to you. And April will kindly bring the microphone over.
Okay, good. I think it's a tremendous discussion, a really important topic, and I've loved it. I very much enjoy small towns, and the focus tonight has been on efforts to foster development in some of the bigger cities in Michigan, but I see towns like Manchester, Michigan, Adrian, Niles, Cassopolis. I could go on. There's 500 of them. And they are just wiped out these days. and I wonder if there's any hope for them. I read recently that some of Michigan's counties have the highest median age of any in the United States. I think it's because a lot of these counties, those counties that consist only of these small towns, anyone who graduates from high school is out of there immediately. And I wonder what hope there is for these little towns.
Lauren, you're working on a couple projects, just specific projects that kind of bridge some of the VC, what we're talking about, and ag tech and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I did a very large project in Huron County and looking at the economic feasibility of bringing kind of a makerspace out there. And they do. 50% of their population is over the age of 55. It is a very heavily gentrified. It's also like 99.9% family farms. But the kind of cool piece about Huron County and the thing we're looking to develop is that the farms are actually going from grandparent to grandchild. And I've got some really cool pictures on my phone of a dairy farm with cows with Fitbits and with... They know, I mean, so the health of their cows, they know their pulse. I mean, there's two huge servers and a bunch of Microsoft Surfaces that you can go in and you can check your entire herd. But one of the things we're looking to do there is actually bring in an ag incubator and link Harbor Beach and Port Hope and all those communities up kind of Sanilac and over to Huron County with Detroit, to bring the technologists who are coming out of the universities up through there with the folks from the ag, the creatives, and give them a place to live and summer and enjoy these small towns and engage. And so we've kind of had this less pen pal and more, as an anthropologist, it's almost like a culture exchange. But one of the things that's been was really eye-opening, particularly after last year's election, was realizing that in the town that we were focused on in Harbor Beach, the average annual income per capita is $23,000 a year. The household income is $32,000 a year. So when we're talking about people with lack, they exist in Detroit. And they exist in these small towns as well, and in this exact same way that it traps you wherever you're at. So we're trying to bring sort of that reciprocity between these communities in Detroit and bring innovation over. And so Dow Ag is over there. There's some other major players. DTE is decommissioning a coal fire plant. So we're looking for funding to do that. But, some of the places you're talking about, places where Ford had small plants and there was manufacturing that supported a solid middle-class income, that's a tough thing to replace.
Jim, may I ask Lauren just a quick follow-up question? Because my response, just to be kind of a jerk, is to say, move to a bigger city. And I know that's not the right answer. What's the optimistic outcome of efforts like yours? Like, what's the best we can hope for these small towns that are, they're changing dramatically, and those people there that were going to say, okay, do it this new way or try it this new way, and they're upset and they're poor and they're unhappy.
Well, the one thing we're trying to do is, so Harbor Beach has got 60 kids who graduate each year. And when we looked at their graduation rates, they're off the charts. We thought, okay, are they just pushing these kids out of school? But we looked at their MEEP scores, and their MEEP scores are great too. If we bring 10% of that class back to create a company there, even if it's just two or three positions where you're making $40,000 or $50,000 a year, you're working remotely. I mean, one of the things about the gig economy is that these people can work remotely from anywhere. And so you want to go back and support your family in Harbor Beach or in Port Hope, you can do that.
I want to challenge this a little bit. There's an incongruity to this argument. And what's happened in the high-growth centers is the cost of living has become insane. So the natural argument would be that it would push out, that people would be moving away. And in fact, in the 90s, I was an advisor at Apple for a number of years. The object was we thought there was going to be rural. But in fact, it's the exact opposite, right? So that tells you that the argument isn't economic. There's a cultural ethos here going on about who want people want to be around, what they want to be around, and there's an expectation about that. Now, economics are things that are relatively easy to finesse. Culture is not. Culture is generational. It's very difficult to deal with. So to me, I think we all want to see entrepreneurship, and we certainly are in some pockets, don't get me wrong, in Petoskey and some other place we're seeing it. But I think the real challenge is how do we make living in Cassopolis more interesting? Okay, a lot of lakes, I can tell you that. We used to swim in them, right? So you've got a lot of pretty stone buildings, but not a lot of nightlife, not a lot of young people meeting other young people. So we'll have to. I think we'll have to leave it up to them to figure out, places to meet and start their lives.
Okay, next question.
Yeah. Thank you all for being here and for the conversation. For those not from Washtenaw County, welcome. Professor, I appreciate the idea of redistributing wealth being a good way to get reelected. That's controversial. It's fun. But I think also a good way to get reelected is by providing what your constituents need today and not allowing wealth to redistribute itself. We're not waiting for that. And I look to two major areas, education and transit, very relevant in the Metro Detroit area. Education is a redistribution of wealth. You're an Ann Arbor resident, 51% of your taxes go to public education. And you're a baby boomer. And so you're probably subsidizing a young family or an immigrant family and allowing those kids to then realize their talent. And then transit, the regional transit authority that failed would have been taking wealth from Macomb or Oakland County and then building a nice choo-choo train from here to Detroit. And I'm just curious, in your minds, what is the role of education and the role of transit, both as means of physical and economic mobility in all of this?
Well, let me start this off, and I'm sure Eric will have a lot to talk about this. There's two things that you're saying that I don't disagree with. And Lauren had raised one really nicely, which is it's not about government money. It's about investability. Do you get anything out of the money, right? And given the recent, being passed over by Amazon, right, if you read the report at all and you could see why we got passed over, the issue is entirely about the education system. It had nothing to do with crime or some of the urban things people talk about. But the second thing that you're raising is a more interesting one, which is horizon. What is the horizon in which we're going to deal with this? So I'll give you an interesting example of this. 31.5% of all trade in the United States is with our partners in Canada, the largest unprotected border in the world. Now, if you know this. The notion of building a second span economically makes perfect sense, or building an airtropolis. These are no-brainers, right? And yet, we don't invest in it. Why? Well, you could say because of graft and corruption and people are being paid off, and that's all true. But the bigger issue is, when does bringing freight in and out of the United States pay to the state of Michigan? And the answer is what? What's aggressive? 7 to 10 years? Aggressively. That starts to pay. So I'm agreeing with what you're saying, but I'm also saying the horizon is different. And you're going to find this with American companies as well. One of the differences between American companies that people get wrong from a lot of other companies, and it's really infecting, we're infecting the world. They're not infecting us. I hate to tell this to young people. But you have to show quarterly earnings. And if you don't show, because investors don't care whether it's aerospace or tangerines. It's about making money. Capitalism requires capitalists, right? This is just, whether you like that system or not, that's the system we live in, right? Maybe we could have a better one someday. So the issue is we're an event-driven economy. We're short-term. We have a lot of firing and hiring ballistically. So remember when September 27th happened in 2007, between that and January 1, we laid off 6 million people, right? But we also hired them back faster than Europe did. Right? We stress test the banks. Europe, 3 years later, 87% of the banks fail. So the notion is we have an economy that's very ballistic, it's very short term, and there's a lot of challenges to that. But there's also an upside. So the only thing I'm challenging you on is, of course, education and transportation's investable. And should have been investable in 1950. But the challenge is the horizons are long, and I think that's what dissuades people. Now, that's one person's opinion. Let's hear from people who are living with this.
So since he talked to the economics, I think I'll talk to the transit. There is a – in fact, trying to get back to the conversation you had about culture, like what do you have in small towns and yada yada, you can't fake culture. But what you also can't fake is memories, right? A lot of people are pretending that the reason why they didn't pass transit is completely economic. The reason why people didn't pass regional transit is because we don't like each other. And I think it's time to be 1,000% 100 with that. I think somebody said, I don't give a damn about giving Detroit buses. We good. Because Ann Arbor don't need Detroiters. And Macomb, damn sure not voting for Detroiters. Right? And that is just where we are. Until we have a genuine, honest conversation about why we have division, why Detroiters don't trust folks from Oakland County, why Wayne County don't trust Oakland, and why Oakland doesn't, and why Elbrooks Patterson is still allowed to be publicly racist as shit.
Oh my God.
Right? And here's the thing. I, as an entrepreneur, I'm a big fan of Elbrooks Patterson's crystal ball. He's the king of crystal balls of isolationism. He got the juice. He has all the juice on, this will change the economy in 4 years, let's insulate. He's also a clear, blatant racist, right? And he's not fake about it. He hated Coleman Young. He went after Coleman Young. It's stuck in his soul. If you read his interviews, he's not shy about it. He hates blacks. He hates Native Americans. He hates Hispanics. He hates everybody that's not white. And so what's happening with him is that he came out, a couple of days ago? He literally just said,
last week
said, I'm not voting for transit, dog. And that there was no economic follow-up. He was like, y'all not getting transit till I'm dead. Mic drop. It was like, okay. So that's why. And so if you look at it purely economic and collegiate, and you say, okay, this is the investment, blah, 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 that's dope. But I think there was a Saturday Night Live joke that went really well about this. When all the white liberals were surprised when Trump got elected, all the black people were like, you guys are surprised that an open racist got elected to a public office? We just stopped doing that openly, like, what, 10 years ago? Like, I mean, we're just getting back to the business. And so that's where we are. Conversations about culture and what we actually need to have is how we move transit. This economic shit is not how you get it done. And that's just my one guy's opinion.
Great. That's great. Great stuff. We have another question.
Oh, sorry. So first a comment on the transportation issue. I was born abroad. So public transportation is a big thing for us. And I'm just always just so incredibly amazed that this huge land doesn't have anything that goes north and south and east and west. And it's easy to take, and it's actually cheap, and it's actually affordable, because if you want to go, say, from Ann Arbor to Chicago, it costs you pretty, you know, expensively. It's like $150 for this past weekend. You can drive here a lot cheaper than that. And then I also sort of commute from Ann Arbor to Holland, so my family's still in the Holland area, and I worked in Grand Rapids for a long time. And I just wanted to get back to you as a middle-aged white man, because I'm a middle-aged Hispanic / immigrant woman, and we don't have it very easy either. And I think one of the things that I like about Grand Rapids is the family-based sort of entrepreneurship community. In the other hand, is a family-based entrepreneurship community. So anybody who doesn't fit the white Christian Reformed or Reformed Christian, whatever they're going for, because there's two different ones. If you don't fit in that, then you're kind of screwed out of luck. If you look at Grand Rapids affordability, I think NPR had a story on it, and 50% of black males cannot find a job in Grand Rapids. If you're a white male in Grand Rapids, you're twice as likely as a Hispanic or black male who's equally educated and has the same experience as to be employed. And that's not even going into the whole female thing. So anyway, that was my comment and question, I guess. I don't have a question.
And Joe, may I just want to say,
And thank you for making that point. You know, I was raised by a single mother, you know, poor, saw the value of education, have kind of worked my way up, and I had benefits being a white man that other people haven't. So I'm sensitive to those sorts of things. And I feel like that's what gives me the ability to at least understand some other perspectives is kind of where I've come from. And I realize that as I talk about that it's like at great risk to my health, you know, to kind of be saying, well, I get you, or at least I think I kind of get you because I've come from this background. You know, in Grand Rapids, it's, you know, talking about just the religion, I just want to make this point. I mean, when I got the job with Meyer, you know, we're, you know, I guess you'd say liberal and not super into religion. I love, though, the values of the community, given the just the people there. But I had some challenges, like, moving there. You know, I was worried, were people of color acceptable? Were you know, gays and lesbians acceptable? Those sorts of things. So that was only 4 years ago. And the city is much more accepting than I thought it was. And I think it's progressing because it realizes, whether it's out of just kind of like being nice or desperation to survive, that it has to be more accepting and more diverse. So we're on that journey. It's going to be a long way, though.
With that one question over here, we've got a few.
Okay, and one over there. Great.
Okay, thank you. No, what you propose, it seems to me, needs the support of the community at large in order for this to be successful. As a kid, for example, when we left Michigan, we on a road trip, we were glad to get back because the roads were so good here compared to other countries. And I think that we've lost the ability as a society, or let's put it this way, Jack Lessenberry mentioned that we tend to think of ourselves now as taxpayers rather than citizens. Citizens are more likely to be willing to spend the money to have for the common good. Taxpayers, no. We want to make sure that we spend the minimum and we don't give a damn about the other person. Your comments on that?
The lack of understanding of infrastructure. I'm on my sixth tire in 2.5 years on a new car. The road that I drive on every day, I'm over near Hogback and you're on River Drive, is like driving on a cheese grater. The people who are taxpayers are myopic, penny pinching, I don't even know what the noun to use here, but people who don't understand. I mean, I remember the first time I rode out, I was a National Science Foundation fellow during my doctorate. When I started being really successful in business, I wrote out a tax check to the IRS that was exponentially more than I made in an entire year, maybe 10 years before. For those 20 seconds of writing out the check, I was nauseous.
They're terrible.
But knowing that children were educated, people were fed, other people, you know, had roads and infrastructure, I'm fine with that. I know that's my set of values. But I agree with you, that flip from bean counting taxpayer back over to community member, I think that's something that, you know, that our millennials and our sort of Generation Zs, I'm hoping that they take us there because I'm going to be too old to do this stuff.
I think there's an issue here. And that is, I started writing about this in about 02 or 03. And I started doing a lot of work. I do a lot of work in the media community. And one of the challenges you have is social media. And there is no community anymore. When you start looking at lines of sight, political ideologies, it's what's called micro-segmenting. And it's something businesses do. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. The news feeds that you take, the people that you listen to believe all the same crap you believe. And what happens is if they don't, you unfriend them. The Spanish Inquisition couldn't have thought of this, right? The notion is there is no Walter Cronkite because there's no middle anymore. Everything's vertical. It's very funny. I did one of the stories on the next idea about this. When I was a brand new PhD, there was a book by Bloom, the Chicago professor, called The Closing the American Mind. I thought this guy was a classicist, an old redneck. And his point at the end of the book was, what's going to happen is we're going to create all this perspectivalism. And at the end, people are going to say that what's true is relative. Well, we're here. We're here big time. And you don't know your neighbor You don't know the people who moved in down the street, but by God, you know the 40 people who go believe the same stuff you would on your Facebook page. And until that changes, I don't see any hope for the middle. Because there, again, I'm sorry to make this economic argument, it's so easy to sell you once I've isolated you ideologically. Once I know what you believe, selling you is a piece of cake, and you know it. But the notion is if you're in the middle and it's a morass, it's hard to find you. But who here is willing to drop out to say, I'm going to get off social media because I know I'm being micro-segmented? This is the naivete that we're all concerned that Big Brother's watching us, but we're taking selfies of ourselves and selfies of each other. We're watching us, right? So in a sense, I think we've created this monster, right? And think about this for a minute in terms of innovation. The biggest innovations, I think, in the last 10 years are how easy it is to co-opt Facebook and social media, right? We all know where this is going. Everybody in this room knows how this drama ends. We don't know the next chapter. We know what's next. And think about simple things like Amazon. If you like fertilizer, you might like black powder and ball bearings, right? The notion is that's what's happening in this world, where we have these micro segments. And until we encounter the loyal opposition meaningfully, there's not going to be another Bill Milliken in this state for a zillion years until we get somebody who actually can talk to the three groups here. Until somebody can do that, I think we're stuck with social media and these incredibly isolating worldviews. And I'm not trying to be a pessimist. I want what you want. I agree with what you're saying. I'm just very disappointed that we went down a road, we bought into a whole ethos that I think is untrue.
Eric, did you want to jump in there?
I did want to say one thing to that point. So I'm clearly a liberal, right? I got a ponytail. But I spend a lot of time in the middle. And even the people who are following me, like on LinkedIn, I'm not in the middle. I'm pretty like, I try to be even keeled on LinkedIn. On Facebook, I kind of go really hard both ways. I'm very pro gay rights, women's rights, black folks, yada yada. And then I'm very pro like, give white people a chance and like give them a second, right? When you have 5,000 people who are following you on one thing who are very passionate, the scariest thing about being in the middle is one day everyone loves you and one day everyone hates you. And it's usually the same people. And so there's this really strange thing where you don't just have to be willing to get in the middle. You have to be willing to be attacked by your friends the minute you disagree publicly. And I get attacked at least once a day by people who loved me the day previous. And so it really requires, and I'm not saying that I'm brave, right, because I'm still on Facebook, right? Like, I'm not that little girl from Florida who was, like, screaming at people. Like, she's serious. She's an activist. But to have the ability to be cussed out and stay in front is hard. And I think we need to give credit to the people who are doing that work. I think there's a YouTube personality named Philip DeFranco. Like, I follow a lot of young folks. Phil DeFranco's really good in the middle. He'll break down the whole story. He'll say his opinion, and he'll say, what do you think? But here's the entire structure of the narrative. There are people in this generation who aren't by the mainstream media, but have created their own channels to get to the middle. And he's got millions and millions of followers. So I think there's hope, but in private, isolated channels.
I just add one thing. I think, Jeff, you were saying, you know, it's easy. It's fish in a barrel. It's easy to segment off parts of the population and market to them. And I think the flip side is true, too. It's easiest to demonize everyone else on social media. It's the road rage, you know, phenomenon where it's easy for me to give you the finger and cut you off, but if we're going to stop and get out the car, oh, wait. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, let's be more civilized about it. Or, quite frankly, when people like to send messages to stateside when we get it wrong. You know? Or we miss a question. It's like, believe me, over email, someone's very willing to tell me where I should go and what I should do with my career and where I'm not qualified to be, and that's right where I'm sitting. You know, and yet if I call them up, which I do, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, wait, oh, I really love the show. I love what you're doing. I just wanted to make this point, you know, and we revert back. And it's, I think, I don't, you know, there's we need to have thicker skin in this new world. I think it'd be willing to take this criticism, but also find ways to communicate that are, I don't know, less in front of them?
I just want to add to this, because I think there's an answer that Joe's getting at, which is what we want all across the board is transparency. Who are you? You're allowed to have an opinion, but I want to know who you are and what who's behind you, who's supporting you, who's paying for you. And if you have that, I think Joe's right and you're right, then I think we move to the middle.
No, you're right. You're very right. You're right.
Joe, can you repeat what he said?
He said people in public should be able to handle this. I think that's right, but I didn't mean to make it about that. We get that all the time. But my point is I think the way people come and treat and attack people personally instead of leaving it to the issue. And I think that's where we're crossing it. We're not talking to
tough it out, Tinkerbell. That's what he told you.
Well, that is what he told me. Believe me, I found it. Yeah. All right. Moving on. Any other questions?
I think we have time for one more.
One more, and then I have one last question I want to wrap with.
You got to give it to the young lady back here.
I'd be really curious to hear what Eric's opinion is of Mayor Duggan. And I'd like to know from the panel: do you think that Governor Duggan will be our salvation?
How do I answer this as politically as possible? This is my opinion on Mike Duggan. And I say this as a person who has spoken to Mike Duggan and looked his wife in the eyes. She's a very lovely lady, okay? Mike Duggan is one of the scariest people I've ever met. Like, to talk to. If you've ever been on the other side of, a negotiator or a conversation table when Duggan wants to get something done, he's the most terrifying person in the world. But I think he is the mayor that we need right now. I think you need a mayor who's willing to say things to all different groups that they don't want to hear. I think you need a mayor who's willing to go toe-to-toe with L. Brooks Patterson because he's been kind of running amok for a long time. I think you need a mayor who's very cognizant of racial divisions, but is also very cognizant of his status as a white man running a majority black city to bring in resources with this ability to have the perception of trust, right? And that's like a messed up thing to say, but sometimes you just don't trust black folks with your money. Now, that sounds like I'm wrong until you look at how much money just appeared in Detroit, like one day when he became the mayor. Now, would he be a great governor? Who the heck knows? Because and I say that because, like we've been saying all day, Michigan is 5 states. You don't have any. Duggan has been saying a lot of stuff that plays well in a urban core that people who are in rural areas still remember. Like, it's like they think people in the rural areas have short-term memories and the people in the hood have short-term memories. We remember what you said about us when you were in Detroit. And now that you're down here trying to get our vote up here in the Upper Peninsula and all of a sudden you love farm country, we don't believe you, right? And so I think it's going to be, if he were to do that, I think it's important that he I think he starts to change his narrative a little bit now to be more regionally inclusive. He's definitely regionally inclusive, but I think he doesn't talk broadly about the region. And so I think that would be something that he would run into an issue with.
Great. All right, real quick, I just want to wrap. Just give me one sentence and your thoughts on this. If this state just were to collaborate perfectly and everything were to go all smoothly, what would Grand Rapids look like? Nate.
You're starting with me?
I am.
If the state were to collaborate well and
everything
we had a perfect outcome. Yeah. We would look like this panel, you know, we'd look a little bit more like this audience. And I hope that's the future, is more tolerance for diverse viewpoints. How about that?
Lauren, what about Ann Arbor? How do you see that changing?
I would see more people from Ann Arbor reaching out into the rural areas, being less, kind of fat and happy about where we are right here, being a little more uncomfortable going out into arenas in urban areas or in hyper-rural areas or in the Upper Peninsula where, you know what, they don't exactly know everything that they're doing, and they're not necessarily the smartest person in the room. And I would love to see that.
Eric, what about Detroit?
I think Detroit would... it's an interesting question. I think that Detroit would diversify in ideology. I think there's a lot of... I think there's a lot of thinking in one part of Detroit, and there's a whole lot of other thinking in the other part, and these two shall not meet. And what they do is they bring ideas to each other, but they don't ask when they come. And so I think we will have a school system built around generating and supporting ideas from lots of different types of folks. I think America's future is the creation of ideas, and I think Detroit could be a place because we need to rebuild that.
And Jeff, what would Michigan, the state, look like?
Well, I like the comment over here about citizenry. I think three things for the state. One, we'd be a more educated state, and we would use the community college system to our advantage. Doesn't mean everybody has a college degree. You could be an apprentice or a millwright, whatever, but the notion is you have skill. Two, I like the idea of off-ramps and on-ramps between all of our metropolitan areas in a way that it used to be. You could go into one part of the state and another part of the state, and you would feel at home. And three, that there would be a very different, and it's funny that Eric is sitting next to me here, a very different narrative for the state of Michigan. I think the narrative for the state of Michigan has to be a narrative that's more diverse, more inclusive, but also more economically focused. Because once you have an economic engine, you know, a rising tide raises all boats. You have to have a way to pay for all that. And most importantly, we'll see. I'd like to see more NPR and more of those kind of conversations that we can have in common and maybe build some bridges in places like in this room. And thanks to Joe and Zoe and all the NPR people who put this on, April. And for 3 years, you guys have been doing great work. Thanks to all of you.
So thank you, everyone, for coming out. Just a few brief things. There's cards here on your chair. You know, with the next idea, we've been asking for 3 years about what are some ideas that are looking to break the status quo in Michigan. We don't know all of them. Is there someone in your neighborhood doing something different, something new? Someone in your class, someone at work who's looking to do something interesting, different, to really kind of break the status quo that we're doing here and make life better, world better for your community? Let us know. Write down names or any way to contact information and leave the cards there on that little... wooden thing on the way out, the wooden railing. I want to thank Bob Skahn for working the audio today. April Van Buren, who really was instrumental in putting this whole thing together. Zoe Clark, our program director. Rick Kluta, just because he's Rick Kluta. And I mostly want to thank our panelists for really taking the time to come here. Nate Lutz drove down from Grand Rapids. He is a Michigan citizen who cares, but he also works at Meijer. Lauren Bigelow is CEO of Growth Capital Network here in Ann Arbor. Eric Thomas is a storyteller and a senior partner with Saga. It's a marketing firm in Detroit. And Jeff DeGraff is a professor of innovation, the dean of innovation at the Ross School of Business. And I'm Joe Lindstroth, executive producer of Stateside. And I say thank you for coming out on a Monday night and having a great conversation.